right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. What's happening? We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here and 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. So that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Colin Suter, Eric Childress will join me. In addition to doing the movie reviews this week, we will also get another report on the films that Eric saw at the Toronto Film Festival, the Toronto International Film Festival. Eric just got back. He gave us a live report from Toronto last week, and now we'll get our second report of some of the movies that we'll be able to see in the coming weeks and months and that he's already seen. We're going to talk about those as well. So that's all coming up. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's jokey time. We're going to talk about some facts about the Emmys. The Emmys will be handed out tonight. So it's a big night for TV. And I'm going to watch the show and then we'll talk about it again tomorrow morning with Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. He will give us his impression of the show and how it went and the winners and the losers and all that cool stuff. So the Emmys are on tonight and we'll definitely talk about that this morning. And we're going to talk about the happiest states. Which states are the happiest? That's all coming up in addition to the Monday morning movie reviews, which are going to be coming in just a couple of seconds. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you'd like to get a hold of us. 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Let me say hello to my group here. Dan Shigrew is my great producer. Hi, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
Good, man. How about yourself?
All right. Did you have a good weekend?
I did have a good weekend. The tea went well on Sunday.
Oh, yes. They had their tea.
Yes, my wife and her cousin. Mm-hmm. And so went as we predicted. Emily and Olivia enjoyed it for about a half hour, at which point Emily tried to pour milk into her tea for the fifth time, and at that point it was time for the three of us to make our exit and go have fun elsewhere. So.
Okay. Well, all right. Good weekend then. All right, and let's go to the newsroom. It's Vic Vaughn who's in the newsroom. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
How are you?
Very well. How you doing?
All right. How was your weekend?
It was great. Spent half of it in Wisconsin. There was Jeannie had a family member's birthday up there. A lot of people came. Felt like a long weekend to me because it was just a... We did. Just had a great weekend.
Did a lot of stuff.
Yeah, ready to go though. I was ready to get back to work.
All right. Well, we're here, and Vic will be in the newsroom all morning. And for those of you who may not know, we are in our second week now without Esmeralda. We no longer have Esmeralda doing traffic for our show, which is really, really sad. But she will remain part of the show. You will still be hearing her voice from time to time. We'll have her on as a guest, and we'll do some of the regular segments that we do with Esmeralda, and we'll do those coming up. But she's no longer working with us in the mornings here doing traffic, which is sad. But anyway, so it's just Dan and Vic and myself. We're here all morning long. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. If you would also like to jump in and talk to us. And now, Dan, you're going to watch the football game.
I'm hoping to, depending on the schedule, I will definitely be recording it, but I'm hoping to watch it live, yeah.
Yeah, okay, because I'm going to be watching the Emmys.
Sure.
So we'll have full coverage of that coming up. And then it'll be interesting, because if the Bears lose tonight, we have to come in here while Hamp and OB and Kaz will be in the building.
Yes.
And there could be tables flipped,
mm-hmm.
stuff blown up.
Yep.
So, but let's hope they're going to. But they're the favorites tonight.
They are slight favorites, yes. So,
all right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens because last week was pretty fun because we came in on a Sunday night. They played on a Sunday night.
Yep. And since no White Sox today, you'll get a double dose. You get pre and post game. So. Prime listening both before and after the games.
Exactly right. All right. Well, that's all coming up here on the station here on 720 WGN. And coming up right after we take this break, the guys are going to be here, Colin and Eric, and we are going to review a bunch of new movies and then hear about some of the movies that Eric saw at the Toronto International Film Festival. That's all coming up. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the happiest states in the country, and we got some Emmy facts. Tonight are the Emmys. They will be handed out tonight. Michael Che and Colin Jost are the hosts, and Yeah, so we're looking forward to that. And then tomorrow morning, Dan Feinberg is going to join us to talk about the results, the winners, the losers, all that cool stuff of the Emmys. So that's all coming up. And as you know, it is Monday morning, and that means that we do the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. And also, Eric's going to stick around, and we're going to get a final wrap-up of the Toronto Film Festival that he got back from. So a ton of movies, and we'll talk about those, what he saw, what he liked, and all that cool stuff. Well, lots of movies to talk about this for this weekend, so let's get the guys here. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Welcome, Colin.
Thank you. Hello.
All right. So let's see. Let's start out with Eric. Why don't you tell everybody about The Predator?
Okay. Well, this is the updated version of The Predator, basically a sequel, continuing the line that began in 1987, this time with Shane Black taking on directorial duties and also co-writing duties with his Monster Squad partner, Fred Decker.
I got to say, Eric, when I saw that credit, I almost cheered.
It was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like Fred Decker, yeah. All right, you know.
Especially considering that they just made this Monster Squad documentary, and you just kind of feel bad for Fred Decker,
yeah.
after that thing. So it was kind of nice that Shane Black reached out. I mean, you know, he reached out to a couple people that from his past,
yeah.
And one of them didn't turn out so well.
Yeah, one of them didn't.
Yeah,
yeah.
We'll get into that maybe in a minute, but. Another military group led by Boyd Holbrook is in the in the jungle trying to get some hostages, and they come across another predator. Holbrook forgets some of the predator's things, and worried that there might be a cover up on the horizon. He mails a bunch of the stuff to his own P.O. box, but instead it goes over to his son and his wife, his son played by the fantastic Jacob Tremblay, who has some development issues, but he's very good with video games and electronics, and he toys around with the Predator stuff, and it basically signals another Predator from outer space to come down and retrieve these things that they were on the hunt for from a predator who stole it from them. Boyd Holbrook gets thrown in military jail, and that leads him into basically another group of inmates, including Keegan-Michael Key, Thomas Jane, Trevante Rhodes, a real kind of ragtag group of guys, and Olivia Munn plays a scientist who specializes in extraterrestrial stuff. Shirley K. Brown basically plays the jerky government guy that is, trying to, get all the predator technology for the government, and it just basically leads to a lot of showdowns between humans and predators. And that's exactly what you should expect out of this movie. And for a movie written and directed by Shane Black, if you go in expecting anything but a Shane Black movie, you'd probably be disappointed. The only serious Shane Black effort that I was not a big fan of was Iron Man 3, and that just didn't feel like it had his voice behind it. Downey brought him in for that, but it just felt like other than those couple of twists that happened during that movie, it didn't really feel like a Shane Black movie. This one to me did, and I just to me it was just basically like watching the A-Team take on the Predator, and I was kind of okay with that. Boyd Holbrook is not exactly, it wouldn't be my choice for a leading man, but he has a lot of help in that group of guys that he surrounds himself with. I had fun hanging with this crew in the same way that you had kind of fun hanging with those tough guys back in 1987. These guys are a little looser. They're a lot more fun to be around. They're a little less serious. And it leads to some fantastic gore. It leads to, a third act that has been reshot and recut, and a few things are a little clunky down there, but it leads to a lot of carnage. And that's exactly what I wanted out of this movie. And I think that this is kind of a perfect study example of what you need from a movie when you need it. And I saw this at the midnight premiere at Toronto after I saw, you know, movies by Asghar Farhadi and, you know, a really heavy Maggie Gyllenhaal film. So this is exactly what I needed at the end of that night. Now, unfortunately, right before that happened, this, you know, the scandal happened with, you know, the casting of the movie, and Fox didn't exactly handle that well, and a lot of critics saw the movie after that, and I'm kind of curious how many of them had the reviews affected by this knowledge, that they all of a sudden wasn't as much fun as it could have been. But I had fun. I'm recommending it. It's my second favorite Predator movie. It's not a huge recommendation, but it's one nevertheless.
Yeah, I liked it too. I thought it was a lot of fun and and really goofy. And I mean, it didn't take itself seriously at all. And the whole ragtag group of criminal guys who break out of those. I mean, how many different vehicles do they have that they use in this movie? At one point, inexplicably, they're in a Winnebago. I'm like, what is going on? But yeah, no, and you know, the camaraderie between all the guys, especially Thomas Jane and Keegan-Michael Key.
Yes,
they're great and very, very funny in it. And the effects are fun. There's a lot of good gore. I'm glad it's an R-rated Predator movie, not a PG-13 Predator movie. You know, everybody seems to just be in the same. Everybody seems to be on the same wavelength. You know, I think Shane Black, you know, established the tone very early on. And even Jacob Tremblay has a good time in this movie. Like, he's, you know what I mean?
Certainly.
And Olivia Munn really gets to kick some ass in this movie. She's terrific in it, man. I also really, really love the casting of Jake Busey. Kind of a throwback to Predator 2. You know, where his dad was. And I was hoping he would be related to him in that character.
Yeah, me too.
And Sterling K. Brown is great. He's got all the, you know, and it just munching on Nicorette gum throughout the entire movie. Boyd Holbrook is probably the only sort of, like, not, you know, he just seems, because he's just this really good-looking guy who's not the most terrific actor in the world. Is he related, right. Is he related to Hal Holbrook?
I believe so.
That's his son?
I think so.
Yeah, because I don't know a lot of Holbrooks. Yeah. That's why.
Or grandson, maybe.
Or grandson. Yeah, it could be grandson. Yeah. But anyway, I thought it was fun, and it's really goofy. The audience I saw it with had a really good time. Lots of laughs. People seem to have a really good time all the way through. So I'm recommending it too. I think The Predator is a very, very entertaining, goofy movie. So there you go. All right, Colin, why don't you tell us about White Boy Rick?
All right, well, this is based on a true story, and it's about a teenager named, and it takes place in the 80s, a teenager named Rick Wersha Jr., played by Richie Merritt, and he's a high school dropout who lives with his father, played by Matthew McConaughey, and his sister, played by Bella Pauly, and, you know, they live in, to say the least, a less than ideal home life. Rick's dad sells guns out of his car. His sister is strung out on drugs. And Rick himself is a street hustler in his own right. And their lives are about to be watched ever more closely by the feds and the drug enforcement agencies who are watching them. And, in fact, Rick ends up being their informant and someone who will wear a wire in certain situations, and it's a tough spot for him to be in. The agents, I should say, are played by Jennifer Jason Leigh and Rory Cochran. And is that meta casting to cast him as a drug enforcement agent for Dazed and Confused? You know, it's no spoiler when I say that eventually Rick becomes a drug kingpin, because it's right there on the poster. It says everything that he became before he turned, 16. And so this is one of these movies that, you know, kind of movies that we've seen a lot of lately, like American Animals and War Dogs and things like that, where, you know, it's a crazy story based on a true story, but, you know, involving guns and drugs and lots of money and young people who don't know what they're doing and all that.
Okay, hang on, Colin, hang on.
Okay.
Hang on one second. We're going to take a break and we'll come back. We know what the movie's about now. We're going to hear what Colin thinks of it, and then we'll find out what I thought of it and what Eric thought of it. That's White Boy Rick coming up right after the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the Emmys, and we're going to talk about the happiest states ranked, and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning also means Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Colin Suter. And we will also get a wrap-up of the Toronto Film Festival as well that Eric just got back from. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin told us about the plot to White Boy Rick, which is the new Matthew McConaughey film, before the break.
Okay, before I do, by the way, I just looked at Boyd Holbrook's IMDb page, and it doesn't say anything about him being related to Hal Holbrook.
Oh, okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah,
I just don't think
he certainly doesn't look like Hal.
I don't know any other person named Holbrook than Hal Holbrook.
That's why
I thought, well, he must be related, but okay. All right.
All right, so White Boy Rick. My problem with this movie happened pretty early on, in that I felt like I was dropped into the middle of it. It doesn't really give much in the way of context for Rick's life and how he got the way, you know, how he turned out the way he did. I mean, of course, you look at his father, and there's some obvious things going on there, but Rick is pretty much already, you know, kind of just destined for, you know, what's going to happen to him, and so there's not much of an arc here, or at least, you know, one that the audience can sort of get a hold of, you know, get a grasp on for the story, and to really care about this kid. He's not a very interesting or likable character. I'd maybe rather see a movie just about his father than about him, you know, because I think Matthew McConaughey, his scenes with McConaughey, I think, are the best ones in the film, because McConaughey's presence adds something to these scenes that I think make it interesting. But when it's just the kid, when it's just Richie Merritt, I kind of found myself tuning out a little bit. Like, I just did not care about this kid when it was over, and they, you know, they say what happened to him and how, you know, what his life eventually became. I was like, yeah, I kind of figured that was going to happen. So what? Which is a bad thing for a movie that's based on a true story, especially one like this. There might be a good film to be made out of this story, but this one just made me, I just felt kind of cast adrift from it, because I think it's missing some important details, some important context to make us really care about what happens to this character. You know, to its credit, it's not, you know, it's not the usual one of these movies, which is filled with a lot of period piece needle drops to propel it, to make it, you know, a Goodfellas wannabe. It's not that kind of film. and I think Belle Powley is also pretty good in it. There's good performances in here. It's just I just didn't care at all about the central character, and I feel like his story. You know, it's the big selling point of the story is that all this stuff happened to him before he was the age of 16. Well, I'm sure if you go to the south side of Chicago, you'll probably find somebody else with that same kind of story, at least a few people with that same kind of story. And, you know, so it doesn't feel that compelling to me. So I'm giving this a big fat pass on it.
Okay. So. Eric?
Yeah, Colin just hit on something that I'm going to circle back on, because my biggest problem with this movie is where it ultimately just kind of ends up. You know, throughout the course of the movie, the filmmaker, Jan Demange, and the screenwriters don't seem to know exactly where they're taking us. And there's for a couple moments, I was kind of glad that it wasn't like Colin said, it wasn't just, you know, the way that the movie's actually being advertised as this kind of like, rise to riches through the, you know, the crime syndicate that, you know, this kid, you know, was going to go through. It was going to look like a Scarface kind of thing for a 15-year-old. I'm glad it wasn't quite going that direction, but it's so confusing. It's kind of weaving and bobbing through all these different storylines that the sort of the key thing about the movie, that this kid was an informant for the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Agency, is kind of lost throughout the way. And, you know, there even adds that had these testimonials from like real life investigators, and it's not like until late in the movie that you're supposed to gather that the government's not supposed to be doing this. And I'm like, oh well, that would have been an interesting way to frame the story, that this kid was being used by the government and then thrown into this really horrific life, and then they take no responsibility for it. But by the time you get around to that, you're just like, so what? And then at the very end, when again they make this point about what happened to this kid and the martyr treatment that they want to give this kid, I almost flicked off the screen. I was just like, wait a second. Like to have a movie called literally, I mean, I know this is his nickname, White Boy Rick, and to make him the martyr when Colin mentioned that there's so many other people that have probably had this story happen to them, maybe without the FBI or the DEA interference in their lives, but that they live this thing out every day. And a lot of people that have gone to jail for nonviolent drug offenses, and this kid, we're supposed to feel sorry because he's done it the longest. No, I'm sorry that you don't get off that easily. And with the exception of McConaughey, who I think is really good in the movie, I think that he hits some great comedic beats during the movie, and I think even when the movie is weaving through these dramatic elements that don't quite fit together, I think he's strings it all together. And I'll watch anything that gives me a couple scenes with Brian Tyree Henry in it. But other than that, again, this is probably even a bigger pass for me than it was for Colin.
Yeah, no, this is not good. I was really disappointed in this movie. I was looking forward to it. McConaughey does not disappoint. He's the best thing in the movie. There's just no question about it. He's great, and you can tell that this is this kid's first. He's not an actor. This kid's not an actor, and you can tell. I mean, that's like very
bad,
very apparent that he can't. He's not an actor, he had kind of in his real life. He had kind of a rough go of it, and he was he was into crimes and stuff like that, and that's how he got the part. But they should have picked an actor, basically. But yeah, the screenplay's all over the place. I didn't care about what was happening. The only time for me when the movie came to life was when McConaughey was on screen, and the rest of it is very confused, and morally, it's like you said, Eric, it just, what we're supposed to feel at the end of this movie, the movie doesn't earn it at all. So I was real disappointed with this movie, and I'm not recommending it, despite the fact that, I think McConaughey is very good in it. But this is a really interesting story that has a lot of potential, but they blow it. I mean, they really blow it with this one. So I'm saying no to White Boy Rick. So, all right. Eric, tell us about Mandy.
Okay. Let's see. We keep this pretty simple on the plot explanation. Basically, Nicolas Cage and Andrea Riseborough play husband and wife who are on, a camping trip. And they just happen to be in the same neck of the woods as a really crazy religious cult. Needless to say, their paths intersect when his wife, Aunt Riseborough's character, is kidnapped. They're going to brainwash her. They're going to do something worse to her. Let's just say the things do not turn out particularly well. And that leads Cage's character spiraling into a madcap whirlwind of colorful revenge.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that enough of a plot for everyone? Yeah. I think that's good, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, you start, with that kind of, plot description. Maybe not a religious cult, but, we've seen revenge films, countless times. We just had one last week that you guys reviewed called Peppermint. This one was premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year, which I did not see then. I saw it more than a few weeks ago. But it was kind of the toast of the town at Sundance amongst the Midnight fans. And, all you heard throughout town after this movie premiered was Nicolas Cage chainsaw fight.
Yep.
That was, you know, and colored me, in, you know, intrigued by that. What I was less intrigued about, and the reason I didn't go see this movie at Sundance, is because the director of the film, Panos Cosmatos, directed a film many years ago called Beyond the Black Rainbow that I found very tedious, you know, kind of a gorgeous film to look at, but just a kind of a tedious, pretentious slog of a, you know, a horse, kind of a psychedelic horror film. And I wasn't really up for, you know, that at a midnight show. In the cold of Park City. Having seen this movie on, you know, basically a screener link on my television at home, I can appreciate that there are people that really enjoy, you know, looking at this movie. I mean, if people are you know, going to this thing thinking that they're going to be getting a madcap whirlwind of revenge for, you know, a good 2 hours, they need to strap in for something, you know, really completely different in many ways. And that's really sort of my biggest problem with this film, is that this movie runs over 2 hours long. To me, there's probably a really great classic in there somewhere between 80 and 90 minutes, because as gorgeous as this movie can be at times, I mean, the cinematography of this thing is off the charts, and it seems that so much time is being spent, you know, setting up these gorgeous shots and lighting them and coloring them in such a certain way that, as far as the momentous drive of this movie, it's not there. And I got tired of waiting for setups and this, all the staring that goes on. And, you know, as crazy as the religious cult can be, I mean, it's just, I mean, everyone talks so slowly, and there's a lot of more staring. They stare at the camera, they stare at each other, and then there's more red and pink and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, you get Nicolas Cage screaming and downing vodka and chainsaw fights and, you know, smashing heads and all these kind of things. And that's all great and all, but there are a lot of fits and starts in between all that stuff as well. And, you know, when Colin and I have, you know, talked lesser of the latest film from Nicholas Winding Refn, you know, that's kind of what it feels like. You know, you have a director who's completely in charge of the visual narrative, but not really in charge of the forward narrative that's there. Yeah, so I can appreciate that people really see something in this movie, because it's unlike most movies you're going to see, but as something I'm going to watch again, sorry, I want to see a much shorter cut of this movie.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys, okay? Eric and Colin are going to hang on here. When we come back, we'll find out what Colin thought of Mandy, the new Nicolas Cage movie, and I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. And that's coming up right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call and tell a joke. We're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and Eric Childress is going to stick around and give us his second report on the films that he saw at the Toronto Film Festival, where he just got back. And then at 5 o'clock, you've got Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. 6 o'clock is the great Steve Cochran. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. But let's get back to the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric described and told us what he thought of the new movie Mandy. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Colin, what do you think?
Well, all I can say is thank God. I thought I was going to be the only one of the three of us, because I really wasn't on board with this either. I pretty much echo everything Eric said. This got to be a really beautiful but tedious exercise in, you know, the exploitation cinema, I guess what you call it. But I mean, it's another bloody revenge film, and I just saw one of those, like Eric said, like last week. I didn't really need to see this story played out again. Granted, this is a much different film than Peppermint, much different from anything else that's out there, and like Eric, I appreciate that. But you know, this is just one of those things. Either it's your thing or it's not. And I just found that it wasn't, aside from a few moments. I think this definitely could be pared down to
you know, an 85 or 90 minute movie, and with all the Nicolas Cage craziness going on, I think that would be delightful. But there's just a lot of kind of self-indulgence going on here that I just wasn't really interested in. I didn't see this guy's last the Beyond the Black Rainbow, and nor am I really very interested in seeing it. And I know that the Refn's name keeps getting brought up between, you know, here and on some discussions that I've seen online, and like I think he would watch this and go, dude, tone it down a little bit. This is a little, you know, let's let the story get in here once in a while. So this was kind of a disappointment for me, especially based on all the advanced word of mouth that I was hearing that this was Nicolas Cage's return to form, and it is, but it's lost among in all this other stuff that is not nearly as interesting. So yeah, I'm glad people are having a good time with it. There's a lot of stuff here to enjoy, but for me personally, it's just not my thing.
Yeah, well, it's my thing. I loved it. I thought it was great. I was with it the whole time, man, and I know it takes forever to get to the crazy payoff, but that stuff is so beautifully shot, and so, I mean, I love the score. I thought all the acting was really, really interesting and weird, and I was just, this movie did have a, like, a hypnotic effect on me. I mean, the pacing was slow, there's no question about it, very slowly paced movie, but it had, like, it had an effect, like a put a spell on me while I watched it. And by the time all the insanity hits, and this is a crazy movie, this movie is absolutely crazy. By the time, you know, the Cage insanity hits and the chainsaw fights are happening and all that stuff, I was on board 100%. And I think it's because, you know, the table was set perfectly for me. I thought the payoff was huge. I laughed a lot during the movie at inappropriate moments. I thought Linus Roach was fantastic as the Charles Manson type cult leader, and I thought all of his minions, they looked like they were Cenobites. He's hanging out with, I didn't know what the hell was going on, and it's got a very distinct crazy look to it. Now, and if I'm not mistaken, his dad is George P. Cosmatos, the director.
It's actually Hal Holbrook.
Okay, there we go. No, but this is confirmed. This is for real. He is George Cosmatos' son. He's a completely different kind of filmmaker than his dad was. So
yeah, he actually did Second Unit on Tombstone, so that'd be a wild coincidence.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, so I think this is, I had not seen the other movie. I liked, but I really loved what I saw here, and I thought it was hypnotic and weird and crazy, and it does have some vintage Cage in it, and I think the whole thing pays off. So I'm a really big fan of this movie. I think it's crazy and great.
I would say, I mean, it is, I think a movie like this, it kind of does matter how you watch it, when you watch it, and it is playing at the Music Box.
Yeah.
And just for sheer visuals, I would recommend seeing it on the big screen instead of seeing it, on demand, which you can. But you know, maybe that's the thing. Maybe just need to watch it on a big screen in a theater and to be ready for it. So
yeah, I watched it in my living room. So
I didn't fall asleep in the theater as easily.
I didn't fall asleep. I watched it very late on Friday night, and I was mesmerized by it. So I thought it was great. So anyway, that's Mandy. All right, so let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about A Simple Favor?
All right, well, this is the latest from director Paul Feig, director of Bridesmaids and the Ghostbusters from a couple years ago. And it's about a single suburban mom of a six-year-old. The mom is Anna Kendrick, and she's the kind of woman who is constantly volunteering for stuff at her kid's school and making the other parents look bad. And just kind of an overachiever in their eyes. And anyway, her son has made friends with another kid, and they want a play date together. Well, that kid's mom is the exact opposite of Kendrick's character in every way. And she's played by Blake Lively, and she has a very dark sense of humor. She's pretty outspoken, and she'll always have the upper hand in every conversation and tells it like it is, no matter how uncomfortable it is. She's that kind of person. And while the kids have their play date, these two moms end up becoming friends over several dry martinis in the afternoons. And Lively's character is married to a once famous writer, played by Henry Golding, who's in also in Crazy Rich Asians right now. And things get complicated when she asks Kendrick to watch her kid for a day while she leaves her business trip. Then things get a little complicated, and probably the less I say, the better. So this is, like I said, from Paul Feig, who has made quite a name for himself as a male director who has made, you know, some of the funniest and most successful female-based comedies of the last several years.
Colin, hang on. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break. And that's the summary of what the movie's about. And then when we come back, we'll hear what Colin thought of Simple Favor, what Eric thought of it, what I thought of it. And then we will talk about Toronto Film Festival as well. So we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN, and we'll be back after the news. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We are going to talk about the Emmys. We've got some facts about the Emmys, past and present. And the Emmys will be handed out tonight, later on. And we'll cover that again tomorrow with Dan Feinberg, all the results and everything. That's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Before the break, Colin told us the plot of A Simple Favor, the new Anna Kendrick, Blake Lively movie directed by Paul Feig. And let's get everybody back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Colin, continue. A Simple Favor.
Yeah, so as I was saying, Feig has been, you know, has been making a name for himself as a male director who's behind many of the most successful female-based comedies of the last several years. And that's because, you know, he knows how to get, you know, he knows how to work with them and get, like, the best and funniest performances out of them. You know, this could have easily been another sort of Melissa McCarthy vehicle or, you know, Kate McKinnon vehicle or, you know, pair those two actresses like that together, two comedic actresses like that together. Here, he seems more interested in making a real movie with real characters who are not just kind of improvising and being loose with it, but they're really he's more interested in getting a really good story here, in not going for big laughs. This is a comedy, but it's not going for big laughs. If something is really funny, it's probably has more of something to do with how you know, Kendrick or Lively or you know are delivering the line more than the line itself. And I think that's he's taking a really, you know, interesting turn stylistically with this film, just by virtue of the fact that of how he cast it and how it's being executed and the tone of it. It's a really interesting, I think, a really interesting movie, just based on you know what you know just how it's presented. I mean, it is a mystery. It is a kind of like a, you know, page turner kind of mystery, or a Gone Girl type thing, you know, done in a very, in a much lighter way than we've seen before, because you know, Anna Kendrick just has that kind of lively, lighthearted personality at the center of this thing. And then you pair her up with Blake Lively, who's just, you know, cold as ice. And it makes for a really interesting dynamic. And you kind of, you know, I was buying into what the friendship that was evolving between them. And I wasn't as invested in the mystery behind what was happening so much as I was invested in the characters themselves who are trying to solve it. And that's not a criticism, but more of a compliment than anything. Well, I really enjoyed this movie. I mean, I think it's funny, but it's also just a really interesting turn from Paul Feig, who, you know, could have easily made just another improv comedy with outrageous gags in it. But he went the other way, and I think it's all the better for it.
Okay. All right, Eric?
I like this movie a whole lot. This is one of the real genuine surprises of the year for me. Obviously I haven't read the book, but from what I get the sense is that the book is more in the lines of, you know, the kind of the typical page turners along the lines of like Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train. These, you know, these mysteries involving women, you know, being taken out of their comfort zones and things like that. and dealing with some different issues of marriage and stuff like that. But Paul Feig seems to be, you know, not necessarily doing a, you know, spoof of, you know, that type of movie, but he is having fun with that type of potboiler. And he has Anna Kendrick at the center of this movie, giving one of my favorite performances of the year. Both Kendrick and Lively give two of the most subtle physical comedic performances that I've seen in some time, and that you just get the sense that, you know, every, you know, part of Kendrick's body is this, you know, like a goosebump that's just wanting to just jump off her body and just to do something, and at the same time needs to retreat when, you know, things start to, you know, really hit the fan for her. And then Blake Lively is, you know, she's like this supermodel on pause, and the you know, the line readings that they have together are just so rich and wonderful and really funny. I mean, Colin's right that, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, this is not Bridesmaids or Spy. This is not that type of comedy, and yet there are huge laughs in this movie just based on the behavior of the characters. Particularly, I mean, they're Anna Kendrick just rules in this movie. Just everything she does made me smile or laugh out loud. And I think that might confuse people who might, you know, do invest themselves a little bit more in the mystery. I think the only time this movie, you know, kind of, you know, takes, you know, a slight off step is when it actually has to kind of sink its teeth into, you know, the sort of the investigation of what exactly is going on in the story. And, you know, that happened, you know, about well into an hour into the movie. But it doesn't, you know, detract too much from it, because it leads to a climax that, again, I think is kind of goofing on those type of outrageous twist-filled climaxes that we've seen time and time again. And it just, again, it all just kind of comes back to these two lead performances that I think are both so wonderful. And I hope people know going in that this is a comedy, because if they don't, the way the movie is kind of being advertised, they may be confused the way my audience was. I mean, I only had an audience of maybe about 30, 40 people tops, but I was laughing louder than any of them throughout the movie, particularly in the reference to one particular French movie that gets brought up during the film, that I don't think any of them, like, what is that?
I was the only person who laughed out loud at
me
that.
Too.
Yep.
Me too. And so I had so much fun watching this movie that it's the kind of movie that I really wanted to go out and, you know, tell people, like, you have to see this movie. Trust me on this. You are going to enjoy it. Yeah, it's my favorite film of the week.
It's terrific. It's really, really entertaining and really funny. Like you said, Eric, I laughed out loud a lot. There were only a couple of other people who laughed with me. We were in the minority. But man, and Anna Kendrick is hilarious in this movie. And the whole subplot with the jealous moms is fantastic. And which is cast by, you know, of Feig stalwarts are all like the moms and dads, the single moms and dads, which has a huge payoff at the end. But I think Blake Lively's really great in this movie. Having been a fan of Blake Lively just on, you know, because of Gossip Girl, she hasn't really had a chance to have a part like this. You know what I mean? Like, this is a great part for her. Because she gets to do her comedy chops as well, and it's a subtle performance, and it's a really good performance. And the friendship between the two women is the core of the movie. And yeah, I think it gets a little long in the tooth towards the end when, you know, you're traveling from here to here to check out this hotel, and, you know, what's the mystery here? I wasn't as invested in the mystery as I was in just the characters themselves, as you said, Eric. But that doesn't mean it's not satisfying, because it is. It's just there's a little stretch in the movie where it just seemed. That Anna Kendrick in a car going to a motel, you know, sneaking around and asking questions and stuff like that. That got a little bit repetitive late in the film. But then again, something comes back and there's a huge payoff as well. I was all over this movie and I thought it was incredibly entertaining and very, very funny and a nice change of pace for Paul Feig, and, you know, who proves with this that he can change up the style really nicely. It seemed to me like it was like Paul Feig doing like an R-rated Lifetime movie. And you know, that's what it seemed like, you know, and I think that's exactly what he was going for. I think that's the tone he was shooting for, was like R-rated funny version of a Lifetime movie with two central performances that are just hilarious and great. So, yeah, no, this is a really, really entertaining movie, like a very, very entertaining film that I think it's the, I too think it's the best movie of the week. So, all right. Well, there it is. Yeah, and it did okay. Well,
I think it did pretty... I mean, I wasn't expecting it to do that much, actually.
Yeah.
So I think it's a pretty solid number, and I think if the word of mouth can take effect, it might translate into something. We'll see next week. Yeah. I mean, if it drops below, like, $8 million, then, you know, it's DOA.
Yeah. Well, I hope people go and see it, because it's a very... It's a really terrific movie, so...
Yeah.
All right, next week, we've got the Michael Moore documentary, Fahrenheit 11-9. We also have Eli Roth's family movie.
Yeah.
The House with a Clock in Its Walls. And then Life Itself, which is not the, obviously not the Roger Ebert documentary.
No.
And then Love, Gilda, which is a documentary about Gilda Radner, which I'm very excited to see.
Right.
So, all right. Colin, thank you, sir. We will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Okay, buddy. There's Colin. And Eric, you stick around.
Okay.
When we come back, pick out some movies that you want to talk about from the Toronto Film Festival, okay?
Okay.
All right. Eric Childress is going to hang out with us. We'll take a quick break when we come back. More about the Toronto Film Festival coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We just finished with the movie reviews, the Monday morning movie reviews, and Eric Childress is sticking around because he just got back from Toronto. We had a report last week live from Toronto with a whole bunch of movie reviews, and now we've got Eric back, and we want to talk about more of them. All right, Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, I think we need to start with, I have a trio of films from Oscar-winning filmmakers that are probably all going to play some role somewhere in this year's awards race.
Okay.
Okay, and considering that last week when I was at the film festival and I started off with talking about Damien Chazelle's First Man,
yeah.
Maybe it's only appropriate that we now talk about Barry Jenkins' new movie, If Beale Street Could Talk. And this is a film based on a James Baldwin novel. Stars Stephan James as a young man. It's like set in the 1950s or 60s, and he's in love with basically his childhood sweetheart. But as the film opens, we discover that he has been sent to jail, and she is pregnant. So the film kind of plays this, kind of has this kind of this episodic but dreamlike feel as it sort of takes us through exactly why he's in jail, breaking the news of the pregnancy to both of the families, and finding out exactly how these lives are going to proceed if they're going to be kept apart through all this time. Barry Jenkins has only made obviously, he's the director of Moonlight, did a film before that called Medicine for Melancholy. And, this is, people have said, it's like, well, this kind of proves that Moonlight was no fluke. And Barry Jenkins, really has it. James Baldwin's work has been, talked about as being kind of unadaptable in a way, because there's a very distinctive voice to James Baldwin. People want to see the documentary I Am Not Your Negro, they can get a sense of, just how, prophetic James Baldwin's prose can be. But this feels like, even without having read the novel, you feel Baldwin all over this thing. It's a beautiful film to look at. The acting is really strong. It just kind of glides you through this period of racism. Not that there's any period doesn't have racism in it, but obviously this very particular time in these young people's lives, and how simple acts can destroy lives forever, for the worse. And it should be mentioned that Regina King plays the mother of the girl in the film, and she is most likely going to be nominated for Best Supporting Actress, if not win it all. frankly. So that's something to look at. That's coming out in late October. It might be expanding sometime in November, but it's a wonderful film that people should really look forward to.
Okay, that's If Beale Street Could Talk, which is Barry Jenkins' follow-up to Moonlight. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, what's next?
Next is a little film from Alfonso Cuarón called Roma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is there a trailer for this? Have you seen much?
Yeah.
There is a trailer for this movie. Okay. Well, this is a movie that's going to be premiering on Netflix later this year, I believe in December. But this is a film that, if Netflix has any sense, they will get this film out in theaters at the very least in the big cities. In a city like Chicago, with people who can, really appreciate what Cuarón does with this movie. This is a semi-autobiographical tale about, loosely based on his family, told through the eyes of the family maid in the film, who is there doing all her daily chores, but it really kind of feels like a part of the family, even while the family is going through, a bit of a crisis in its own existence. And then she comes upon her own crisis when she also finds herself pregnant and basically abandoned by the child's father, and having the family support her through, these several months in her life. And again, this is a film that has this dreamlike quality. It's filmed in black and white, gorgeous black and white photography, and takes us, this lyrical, way of looking at this family and this maid's journey through, whether or not she, is going to have this baby or not. And it's a film that, while I was watching it, it was the last movie I saw at Toronto before I left, and I'm so glad that I got to see it on a really big, giant screen, because it reminded me of the types of films that I studied in film school, the kind of films that, that weren't necessarily studied for the overall narrative arc, although this film certainly does have one, but the kind of films that you would study for the images and the way that they all sort of have, each image had its own meaning, and each image, would later pay off into something greater, and how every image in the film amounts to the greater whole of the film's existence. It's a really beautiful piece of work that I was just thinking about all the way to the airport and beyond, and whether I see it on Netflix or Blu-ray or whatever, it eventually is going to, come out. I hope that people will get a chance to experience this movie in a theater, because there are some wonderful references to his own filmography and, sort of inspirations that he's had over the years, particularly for Gravity, which is kind of funny in the film. But it's a beautiful work of art. It's called Roma.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it, man. So, all right, yep. Eric, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, there you go. More about the Toronto Film Festival right here with Eric Childress when we come back right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio right here on Wacker in downtown Chicago. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to tell a joke. As we do every Monday morning. And we did the Monday morning movie reviews, and now we're getting a follow-up, our second report from Eric Childress, who just got back from the Toronto Film Festival and is telling us about some of the movies he saw. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, man. Where do you want to go next?
Okay. Well, this will tail end the Oscar-winning filmmaker discussion and lead us into sort of a discussion of two films involving powerful women. And the first of those has to be Steve McQueen's Widows. Set right here in Chicago, people have seen the trailer. It's a story of a group of widows who were married to basically a gang of thieves led by Liam Neeson. And as their latest job goes bad, just as the film opens, they all become widows. And that includes Viola Davis, who was married to Liam Neeson, Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki, and Carrie Coon. And they are the widows in question. And this is a film that, it seems like this is a setup for the next Oceans movie, in a way, a much darker versions of the Oceans films. And it has that sort of that kind of element about it, but in a far less slicker way. These are not hardened criminals that are going to now attempt to pull off the next job on their husband's wish list, basically because their lives become endangered due to some really nasty politics happening in our wonderful city of Chicago that involves not just Colin Farrell and his father, played by Robert Duvall, but also the people running against him for the local alderman spot, played by Brian Tyree Henry and his brother Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out. So the cast alone should get anyone excited for this movie. But and I've been kind of an outlier with Steve McQueen's work. I'm not the biggest fan of 12 Years a Slave, Gravity Forever, and I was not a big fan of Shame, and the Hunger Strike movie. I don't care about people with hunger strikes, but anyway, but this movie just really zings. It roars. It's fast paced. It's really suspenseful at times. It has this great intersection, involving Chicago politics and crime and, the inner cities, and violence in Chicago. It has all these things going for it. It's such a crackerjack cast, with a number of twists and turns. And again, Viola Davis probably going to be nominated. This is Elizabeth Debicki's coming out party. Though she's the one that's going to be, is going to be the standout. I'm pretty certain she's going to get a supporting actress nomination. Again, Brian Tyree Henry can do anything, as far as I'm concerned. Colin Farrell, I'm happy he, continues to be all over the place. He's terrific. This is a film that people are going to discover. I know they will, because it really is that good.
Okay. Comes out in November, and it's called Widows.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, what's next?
This is a film that I know you very much want to hear about. It's a film called Her Smell.
Yeah.
Which was always fun when you hear people introducing this film. I'd like to introduce Her Smell to you at the festival. But this movie is the latest film from Alex Ross Perry, and he has teamed once again with his Queen of Earth leading lady, Elizabeth Moss. And in the film, she plays what can best be described, I guess, as a Courtney Love-ish type rock star of an all-female rock band. And she's certainly living the life. She is the prototypical bad girl of rock. That she's not great to her bandmates. She has their voodoo ceremonies in the dressing room. She's not good with her manager, the record producer, played by Eric Stoltz in the film, a really nice bit of casting. And it's unpleasant to watch. At times, it frankly is very unpleasant to watch. But this film again is another kind of episodic story. And watching the film, I was struck by whether or not Alex Ross Perry was inspired by what Danny Boyle and Aaron Sorkin did with Steve Jobs. I can't say for certain, but that's the structure that this movie kind of plays out. That it was there was three very specific events in Steve Jobs' life. This one, has five, and each one is much more interesting than the next. And again, if this movie had kind of stopped around the 80 or 90 minute mark, as it deals with the first three sections of this kind of the self-destructive spiral that this character is taking, you might walk away from the film with a kind of a heavy heart, and whether or not you really wanted to see that, needed to see it, enjoyed it in any matter, and probably the same way that, the experience of watching Queen of Earth was. But this film goes further than that, and it leads us into what happens after the downward spiral. And you have Elizabeth Moss at the center of this film in what I think is my favorite performance from the festival this year. She is brutally fierce through the first three-fifths of this movie, and then really sad and, you know, I don't want to spoil too much
right. Where
this film is headed, because it's very personal when you watch this movie, and it's suspenseful, it's funny at times, it really, gets who this character is, and what she's going through. And Nick, I don't think you've ever, probably in your life, ever shed tears to a Bryan Adams song. I promise you, you will during this movie. Mark that down.
All
you
right.
will shed tears during a Bryan Adams song
All
in this movie.
Right. I will mark that down.
Yeah. This was easily my biggest surprise of the festival. I like Queen of Earth. I don't like it nearly as much as you do.
Yeah.
But this one had so much going for it. This is the movie that I want to share with audiences.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. You know how I felt about Queen of Earth. You know how much I love Elizabeth mm-hmm. Moss. I think Elizabeth Moss is right now the best actress on the planet. And her work with Perry, that the last movie was just, I thought, amazing. And when I heard about this and I read about it, I watched like a little, they have a teaser clip for it. And I was like, I cannot wait to see this thing. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. All right. So that's Her Smell with Elizabeth Moss. That doesn't have a release date yet, though.
It doesn't have a distributor. Okay. No, yeah, we're still waiting to see who picks that thing up. And I'm hoping maybe Magnolia or IFC does.
Yeah. Okay. Great. All right. What's next?
I got a couple of very interesting true stories that are, kind of have a similar arc to both of them. And the first of them is a movie called Driven. And this is a story about John DeLorean, who is played in the movie by Lee Pace. Mm. People who, when you say DeLorean, you think of one thing, Back to the Future.
Exactly.
Okay. This is a story, people who don't know that much about that, this particular piece of history, know that it was much more than a car. It was also the subject of a very large drug deal that eventually led to DeLorean's downfall. Now, while Lee Pace plays DeLorean in the film, the movie's central character is actually played by Jason Sudeikis, who is actually a drug runner. He's a pilot. He runs drugs for Michael Cudlitz in the film, and he's just kind of a dopey, Sudeikis-y kind of guy. He kind of wants to be liked. He's fast talking. He's definitely a shady character. But he gets caught at the beginning of the movie and is roped into working with the FBI, led by Corey Stoll. And he just happens to move him in next to John DeLorean. It then targets their friendship and how this one lowly drug runner eventually ensnared all these people into this, this deal, seemingly almost without his knowledge, that it just kind of all by osmosis, just all kind of all came together, because DeLorean is not, that great a guy. And unfortunately, this is not that great a movie either. You want to do a story about DeLorean, maybe do the story about John DeLorean and not his neighbor. It's really unfortunate that there's probably a really interesting story here about who this guy was and why he was so into, getting this really stupid car made. I didn't stick around for the last couple minutes of this movie because I had to run to something else. The story had been told out by then. But up to that point, there's no mention in the film about Back to the Future. Not once. There are references to the car looking like a flying car. I don't know if that's their snarky way of, suggesting what happens at the end of the movie. But, the only reason anyone remembers who DeLorean was is because of Robert Zemeckis.
Right. Okay.
All
right. Well, that's Driven. And how many movies are going to be called Driven?
There's the Stallone movie,
right.
The race car movie.
Yeah.
What else is there?
I can't. I just remember the Stallone movie because Rennie Harlan directed it. That's the only.
Of course, he did.
okay, so that's Driven and not recommended. By the way, the guy who directed that movie directed Godsend, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life, and contains
Nick Hamm.
Yeah, and contains.
I knew that name sounded familiar.
Which contains the worst Robert De Niro performance of all time, which says something.
Yeah.
Right, okay, Eric, hang on. Okay.
Yeah.
Hang on. Eric Childress is with us. We'll take another quick break. We come back. More movies from the Toronto Film Festival. Getting exclusive looks here right on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. It's a Monday morning, and that means that my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We did the Monday morning movie reviews, and right now Eric is sticking around. He goes to all the film festivals and reports on them for us, and we've got some more movies to talk about from the Toronto Film Festival as well. And Steve Grzanich will be here at 5 with the opening bell, and at 6 it's Steve Cochran and the Morning Drive, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Right now, though, let's get back to talking with Eric about the Toronto Film Festival movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, where do you want to go next?
Well, I mentioned another true story, and this is actually it's a documentary, and it's called Screwball. And this is the story of the steroid scandal in baseball, specifically centered around Tony Bosch, who is the quote-unquote fake doctor who prescribed and supplied a lot of these illegal drugs to the likes of people like Manny Ramirez and Ryan Braun from the Brewers, and most notably Alex Rodriguez.
Right.
And the story, you know, gives us the entire spectrum of exactly, you know, who Tony Bosch was, how he got involved in this business, and how he eventually attracted the interest of baseball players who found themselves having, you know, a pep in their step after taking his very interesting concoctions, and the subsequent lies and denials that eventually came from that. You know, this is a movie with not a lot of good people in it. It's a film, but at the same time, it's, you know, it's more or less framed as a comedy because so many of them are so incompetent and full of their own grandiose, you know, way that they think that they fit them their way into the story. There's a you know, one guy in the movie who basically is, you know, this dope that just wanted to get, you know, get a little extra. He was not a baseball player, not a famous guy at all, but he just heard about Tony Bosch and wanted to, you know, get in better shape, and it just led him to being part of the business and not getting paid back and threatening to blow this story up, and is exactly how it got into the papers. And yet he's, you know, kind of sees himself as this hero, but he's this moron that completely just screws up so many things. And again, you know, this is not a this movie, you know, implicates Major League Baseball in a lot of things. You know, it doesn't make Robert Manfred look like a great guy. Again, it's a very thorough doc, and they do something really funny throughout, is that instead of doing actual recreations of specific events in the film, they actually use children dressed up in bad wigs and and mustaches and mouthing the words of the people of the talking heads telling the story. So you got all these kids, you know, playing these, like, you know, these low-level mobster types and businessmen and whatnot, and it's really this clever thing that they do throughout the film that I had a ball watching every time that one of the kids would show up and reenact these things. It's a really, I mean, it's from the Billy Corbin, who did the Cocaine Cowboys documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, this is, I mean, clearly he's got a thing for Miami and Florida, because this is another story set in this really horrific part of the world. You know, as there was they say in the movie, as they said on 30 Rock, the penis of America.
That's right.
Yeah. So, so Screwball, I highly recommend this documentary. It's a lot of fun.
All right, cool. That sounds great. Okay, we got time for just one more.
One more. Okay. Well, let me give you a film that I'm sure that you're also looking forward to. It's the new film from Jeremy Saulnier. And it's called Hold the Dark. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Saulnier, the director of Blue Ruin and Green Room. And this is an adaptation. Macon Blair, the star of Blue Ruin, actually adapted the screenplay for the film. And it's Jeffrey Wright, the great Jeffrey Wright, plays a guy, an author who wrote a book about killing a wolf. And he gets a letter from a woman in Alaska, played by Riley Keough, who tells him, writes to him that her son was taken by wolves, that the area that she's living in, this little kind of outpost area that's, you know, partially, you know, it's almost like an Indian reservation, is the string of children are being taken by wolves out in this area. And would he come out to help and track him down, either track down the boy or kill the wolf that took him? So he does come down there. And discovers some really peculiar things going on in this this remote area. Alexander Skarsgård plays the husband, Keough's husband, who is off in, I believe, like, Afghanistan. He's fighting one of the wars, and he's got some PTSD issues himself. And when he returns to this area, well, things get a whole lot more shakier than you could even imagine. This is a film that has a number of twists and turns. Anyone, you know, if you've seen Blue Ruin and Green Room, obviously you have. You know, that's the kind of thing you can expect from Saulnier.
Right.
But this one, I believe, is a bit of a misfire. Mm-hmm. I'm really sorry to say it doesn't have that kind of frenetic suspenseful pace that Green Room had. It doesn't have that sort of that real episodic sense of discovery that Blue Ruin had with its revenge tale. It's got bits and pieces of his previous films and the sort of the themes that he explored in those movies, but it's a really lethargic, slow-moving tale that does have moments of really great carnage in it. There is a shootout sequence that is the centerpiece of this movie that is just horrifically violent. James Badge Dale, I should also mention, plays the local sheriff in town. He was in a number of films at Toronto that I saw that, and he was great in every single one of them. Need to see more of that guy. But it leads you on a path, and I'm really sorry to say that Jeffrey Wright, you know, he finally gets a lead role in a movie, and he feels so inconsequential throughout this entire movie. You know, it just feels like there's a, you know, and it pains me to say this, but it's like watching an old man kind of dodder around, you know, an area that we know he's not up for the challenge for. We know that he's not, you know, he's probably not going to be the hero of the story. And it's just, it's painful to watch. It kind of made me wish that his character was moved into James Badge Dale's character, and then we'd have a little bit more of a what's going to happen, because we really just don't have the sense that anything is going to turn out, you know, in any positive way in this story, which is not always a bad thing, but it's just so lethargic, and it doesn't really seem like it earns the kind of carnage that it has throughout.
Right.
So I think this is a real misfire from Saulnier.
It's too bad, and it's going to be on Netflix at the end of the month. So
yeah.
Okay, that's Hold the Dark. All right, Eric, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it. We will talk to you next week.
Absolutely.
Okay, take
thank
care.
You.
Eric Childress, everybody. All right, we'll take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Hope everybody's doing well. So tonight is the Emmys. The Emmy Awards will be handed out tonight. And they'll be on NBC, I believe, starting at 7. But I think the red carpet coverage started last Thursday. So that's that's always fun to watch. But, you know, we've had Dan Feinberg on last Thursday morning, and to ask him what his thoughts were and who he thinks is going to win and who he would like to win, and all that cool stuff. And he really wants, really wants this person to win.
Hi, I'm Carrie Russell, and I love Nick's radio show.
I know you do. For the Americans, and this is kind of like her last chance to win because the Americans ended. So if she wins, Dan will be very happy. I'll be very happy too. So anyway, we're going to get Dan Feinberg on tomorrow morning with us, to talk about the results and, how the show was and all that cool stuff. But right here, I got some star studded facts about the Emmy Awards just to get you prepped. Everybody's getting ready and prepped. Dan, as you know, in like, 4 months, it's going to be all awards shows.
Mm-hmm.
The awards season begins and it goes nuts. And it's interesting how the Emmys, you know, are always like the first one, the first award show. But then there's a couple of months in between because, you know, you got to have the end of year stuff and then all the nominees and everything gets out. But it's funny how the Emmys always fall in that weird sort of area where, I mean, it's like it's the end of the summer.
How often is it on a Monday night?
It's usually almost all award shows are on Sundays.
Right.
You know, most of the award shows, I would say a vast majority of award shows are on Sunday. I don't know why it's on Monday. It's weird because it's not,
it's NBC, so that's Sunday Night Football.
Mm-hmm.
That would probably be a better ratings draw at this point.
Right.
Because those typically are the highest rated broadcasts of a broadcast you're given usually, even if other shows are stronger. So I wonder if that has to do with it. Because I don't think it was on NBC.
It's the Emmys. I don't know why. I always associate the Emmys with CBS.
Right.
For some reason, which is why I said last week when I was plugging it, I was like, yeah, CBS. And then I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be. Because Michael Che and Colin Jost are not going to be working at CBS. They'll be working at NBC. Because it's usually, you know, I always thought the Emmys was CBS. Tony's is usually CBS. Oscars is ABC. So I don't know. Hey, by the way, you did see that the Academy decided that they're not going to do the popular movie. That's a smart decision because that was a dumb idea. That was a dumb idea to do to add a category to the Academy. I don't know. They're trying to get more people to watch.
Right.
And I don't know what, you know, they thought adding this popular category and then they're going to, you know, not do all the awards that they normally do because the ratings were really low last year.
Right.
And so, of course, it's really easy to blame Jimmy Kimmel for that, but just that's not the case.
Right.
Kimmel was terrific. He's really great. And I don't know who's hosting this year. I don't know if they've announced it.
I don't know if they have either.
I don't think they have.
I think it would have been interesting watching just to see what they would have nominated and if there would have been any crossover.
Yeah.
Best Picture.
Yeah.
You know, and how do you play that?
Well, I mean, you know, the Avengers would be the Infinity War would be up there.
Right. But Black Panther would be the one that everybody would be talking about that could possibly be a Best Picture, but also Best Popular Picture.
Right.
Considering it kind of crossed into both of those genres.
It did. And it also was a major social moment, too.
Right.
I mean, it was the zeitgeist for a while of what was happening. And on many levels, Black Panther was important. You know, for one, it's just a terrific movie. That's, you know, just really good. But it also was a, you know, it was a huge statement.
The other interesting thing that I saw that they were going to do, I don't know if this has been scrapped as well, but have some of the awards presented during the commercial break.
Right.
And then just show the acceptance speech.
Right.
I remember they had tried to negate that awkward time of people walking up to the stage and, you know, however 20 seconds, 30 seconds that cost by having, you know, a microphone in the middle right by close. But, and this might be a way around that as well.
Yeah, I remember when they were out in the audience, you know, like the accepting. I don't know. I just don't think that's cool. I think everybody needs to get up on stage and say their, you know, and give their thanks. It's a once in a lifetime thing.
I agree with you. I think as opposed to a 12-minute production telling me how great movies are,
yeah,
let the people who are the award winners this year show me how great movies are.
I agree with you, man. I agree with you 100%. I always get angry when, you know, when they cut people off. I mean, one of the things that's great about it, I mean, I want to hear acceptance speeches. I don't care how small the category is. I know a lot of people don't care, but I do. I care about, like, every, I'm interested to see who wins every single category, you know, and to see what they have to say. But I, you know, I don't know. It's live TV. Let somebody, you know, because you never know what's going to happen. That's another thing about it. It's that you never know what's going to happen on live TV. So, but anyway, the Emmys are on tonight, and we have some facts about the Emmys. The word Emmy comes from a camera tube. Did you know that, Dan?
I did not.
When the Television Academy was brainstorming a name for its new awards back in the late 40s, founder Sid Kassid, boy, that's a name right there, Sid Kassid, first suggested Ike, a.k.a. the nickname for a television iconoscope tube. But the other members worried that the term was too closely linked to World War II hero and future president Dwight Eisenhower, and therefore might seem too political. Instead, Henry Lubke, Emmy, I-M-M-Y, it would reference another piece of TV tech, the Image Orthicon tube. The rest of the team decided to feminize it into Emmy so that it matched the statuette that they had collected. You know, a lot of people thought that that was named after, like, a woman. You know, I mean, they did feminize it, but it's actually from a camera tube inside the TV, which no longer is there. So, does anybody still have TVs with the back on them?
Oh, yeah, because we get occasional when we're talking about, you know, tell us about the oldest thing in your house topic. People will text in that
tube
television.
They got the tube television.
And there's like three shops in Chicagoland that still sell the tubes.
Right. Dorothy McManus was the model for the statuette. Kassid and his friends considered 47 design proposals for their award statuette and promptly rejected all of them. But the 48th time was the charm. Television engineer Lewis McManus' design of a woman with wings holding an atom was the one that the team reviewed, but it turned out to be the winning pitch. The wings represented the arts, and the atom represented the science. McManus had modeled the woman on his wife, Dorothy. So that's Dorothy McManus. All right. Only six awards were handed out at the first ceremony, and one went to a ventriloquist. The very first Emmy Awards ceremony was held on January 25th, 1949, at the Hollywood Athletic Club. Unlike the current iteration, it was a fairly cheap affair. Tickets only cost $5, and the runtime was a lot shorter. Only six awards were handed out that evening, the first one for Most Outstanding Television Personality, and it went to 20-year-old Shirley Dinsdale and her puppet Judy Splinters for the Judy Splinter Show. Other winners included a program called Pantomime Quiz, and Louis McManus, who won a special Emmy for designing the thing. So they gave the guy an Emmy that year?
Apparently so.
That's pretty... Come on, man.
And that was one of the six awards.
Six awards, and one of them goes to the guy who got the special Emmy for designing the award. Oh, man. Now, the Emmys usually is a pretty good show, the way they set it up, because they do, I think they do comedy first, right? And then they do the comedy awards, and then, like, reality awards, and then drama awards. I think that's how it's set up.
That sounds right.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think the comedy goes first, except for at the end. Because at the end, they'll do comedy and drama, the big, you know, the shows, the big ones at the end. Yeah, I think Che and Joe still do a pretty good job. You know, I would imagine that they're going to split some of the duties up. Like, Joe still come out, do a bit, introduce somebody, and then I think Che will come out. But the thing about those guys now is that when they first took over Weekend Update, their chemistry wasn't really there. And Che didn't even, it seemed like Michael Che didn't even want to be there. Like, but they've really grown together, and they're both really, I mean, I think they're both really funny on Weekend Update, and they've developed a rapport, and their personalities are completely different. So, but I like Che likes to just acknowledge the jokes all the time. like how stupid the jokes are sometimes. He'll just be like, and you know, like Jost writes most of them. Well, they're both co-head writers now. And he likes to acknowledge how stupid some of the jokes are, which I always love. I always love when someone is doing a bit or a monologue or something and a joke goes wrong and then they have to acknowledge it. You know who else does that great is Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers, well, you know, he's got Weekend Update experience too, but he does a great job when a joke like bombs or they laugh really hard at something. Like, what are you laughing at? Also, you know, speaking of Seth Meyers, I think he's nominated. I think the show, his show is nominated tonight as well. I'm pretty sure it's nominated tonight. It is. And like I said, we talked about the variety, late night variety shows that are all nominated. And with the exception of James Corden, who's got no business being in there. If he wins, that's ridiculous. But he also has Seth Meyers also has he does a great job with his writing staff. He brings him in. I've talked about this. I talked about her before. Amber Ruffin is absolutely hilarious. And when she gets to come out on stage and do her Amber Says What stuff, or when she comes out and another writer comes out and Amber Ruffin is black and the other writer is a lesbian. And so it's a bit called Jokes Seth Can't Tell, because he's neither black nor a lesbian, so he feels uncomfortable doing the jokes. So they come out and do them. And at the very end, they go ahead, Seth, tell a joke. And then he does one, and they go, oh, that's offensive. And it always ends with black people and black women and lesbians are liars. That's what it's always Seth Meyers. But whenever those jokes bomb, it's hysterical. So, all right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. I love the fact that this guy got an Emmy for designing the Emmy.
Yeah, why not his wife? I mean, she did the work. She probably held that at him for a very long time.
All right, we got a break. If you're watching the Emmys, give us a call. What are you rooting for? What are you looking forward to? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Hey, good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here in the Allstate Skyline studio. On a Monday morning, my dad's going to be calling in to tell a joke, because it's a jokey time on a Monday. Every Monday morning, we have my dad call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the happiest states in order of happiness. And I'm not really surprised at number one. I don't know. At the number one state of that's the happiest state. I'm not surprised by that. And I'm also not surprised by where Illinois ranks. So we'll get to that. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Been talking about the Emmys. The Emmys are on tonight, where all the best TV gets awarded. And I've got some facts, some star-studded facts about the Emmy Awards over the years. And that's what we're talking about here. And if you want to jump in, if you're looking forward to the Emmys, you're going to watch them tonight. And who are you rooting for? Who do you hope wins? How do you think Michael Che and Colin Jost are going to do? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Speaking of Che and Jost, the repeat of the SNL rerun this weekend was Donald Glover, Childish Gambino, which is a really good episode. That's a really strong and funny episode. Okay, so here's another fact about the Emmys. Best continuing performance in a series by a person who essentially plays herself used to actually be a category. Wow. In the early years of the awards, the Emmys tested out a number of categories, some of them more logical than others. But the most nonsensical pair came in 1958 when the Television Academy decided to honor the, quote, best continuing performance in a series by a comedian, singer, hostess, dancer, MC, announcer, narrator, panelist, or any person who essentially plays herself, along with the male category, the identical male category. Dude, that rolls right off the tongue.
How about it?
You know you got a problem when the name of the category is a paragraph long. That right there is that. It may not work out. Rumor has it that the categories were mostly designed to honor Lucille Ball for I Love Lucy. But if that was the intention, it failed miserably because Dinah Shore won for the Dinah Shore Chevy Show, while Jack Benny took the male category for the Jack Benny Show. These categories ended in 1959. So it lasted one show, 1 year. Best continuing performance in a series by a comedian, singer, hostess, dancer, MC, announcer, narrator, panelist, or any person who essentially plays herself. All right. How about this little fact? Jackie Kennedy is the only first lady to win an Emmy. Jackie Kennedy received a special trustees award for her famous televised tour of the White House in 1962. Lady Bird Johnson accepted the statuette on Kennedy's behalf. No first lady has matched her Emmy count since. Although Michelle Obama came somewhat close, she received Emmy attention when her Billy on the Street segment earned a 2015 nomination. Alas, it lost to Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. Wow, Between Two Ferns won an Emmy? I didn't know that it won an Emmy. That's pretty funny. I also love the fact that Michelle Obama was on Billy on the Street. They got Billy on the Street now. It's not. It's no longer on True TV. It's just it, now. It's just it's on the web now.
Oh, really?
Back to just being on the web. Yeah, which sucks because I used to. Because I love Billy on the Street, and I know some people have. You know, some people have not a lot of patience with Billy Eichner. You know what I mean? Because it's just basically him screaming in people's, running down the street and screaming in people's faces with a microphone. I think he's hilarious. I could watch Billy on the Street. One of the greatest episodes of Billy on the Street ever is the Julianne Moore episode. The Julianne Moore is one of the great. It's one of the funniest episodes of that ever. They got a new one. He posted a new one up. Him and Emma Stone. So. Hey, by the way, have you seen the trailers for this new Netflix show?
I have not.
It's called Maniac, and it's with Emma Stone and Jonah Hill reuniting for Superbad. And it looks really weird. The guy who created True Detective.
Mm.
It looks weird, man. Like sci-fi, weird, crazy.
Is it a drama or comedy?
It's
or
science fiction. It looks to be serious. But they're inside each other's. They're manipulating their minds because they're both depressed. And they go to this facility that wants to cure them of their whatever's going on, and they get inside their head, and there's adventures and all kinds of weird things that happen where they become different characters, and it looks cool though. And I love both of those people, and they were great together in Superbad. So, boy, that's been a long time then too, right? Like 13 years since Superbad,
at least, probably.
Yeah. All right. We got a break here. The news is coming up, and then I've got more Emmy facts coming up your way, right here on WGN. Oh, well, good morning, everyone. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, and we're here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. So the Emmys will be handed out this evening, and it's the 70th annual Emmy Awards. Michael Che, Colin Jost are your co-hosts, and A lot of TV shows and a lot of people we're rooting for, and it should be a fun show. The Emmys are always pretty entertaining. Like I said, the red carpet coverage started on E! Last Thursday. So we'll get a bunch of that stuff in, too. So as a result, because the Emmys are just a few hours away, we have some star-studded facts about the Emmy Awards. We discovered where the word Emmy comes from. We found out who the model was, and there were only 6 awards handed out at the first ceremony, and one of them went to the guy who designed the Emmy. One of the most ridiculous categories ever was discontinued after 1 year. Best continuing performance in a series by a comedian, singer, hostess, dancer, MC, announcer, narrator, panelist, or any person who essentially plays herself. And the male counterpart of that award. That was 1 year, and it didn't work out. And then Jackie Kennedy is the only first lady to have won an Emmy. All right, how about this one? The Super Emmys were a huge flop. In 1974, the Emmys decided to get experimental with the so-called Super Emmy ceremony. The show pitted the winning performers from the drama and comedy categories against each other. Think best lead actor in a drama versus best lead actor in a comedy, best supporting actress in a drama versus best supporting actress in a comedy, etc. God, who thought that would be a good idea? The ultimate champions would be crowned the actor or actress of the year in their respective categories. And the big winners included Alan Alda, Mary Tyler Moore, and Cicely Tyson. The next day, the New York Times wrote that the broadcast was more confusing than ever and that the new Super Awards are pointless. Things went back to normal then at next year's ceremony. Wow. I don't remember that, the Super Emmys. Sounds like a fantastic idea. And speaking of Alan Alda cartwheeled down the aisle for his 1979 win. He made a bigger splash at the Emmys just 5 years later during the 1979 ceremony. He picked up a prize for his writing on MASH. Although he'd previously won acting and directing awards for the show, he'd never been recognized for writing before. He was very excited, so he cartwheeled down the aisle. And it is now an iconic Emmy moment. Why am I having a hard time picturing Alan Alda doing a cartwheel? Why is that?
It would not strike me as a graceful cartwheel.
No. And the way they've described it here, and again, I don't remember this. This was in 1979. I don't remember it. But if he cartwheeled down the... Did he do, like, multiple cartwheels? I mean, was it just, like, boom, 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 all the way down the aisle? Do they have footage of this someplace, Dan? Is there videotape of Alan Alda cartwheeling down the aisle?
There is on YouTube. All right. Let's see here. I'll give you some play-by-play. Oh, he lets the camera move back. One. He just does one.
Oh, it's just one?
Oh, they cut it out so he could talk about it.
Oh.
Let me see if I can get the actual footage.
So they edited it then? Because I, yeah.
Oh, it's like a post thing. So they're talking to Alan Alda today.
Oh, I see. And it's about him talking about that moment.
Right.
Okay. Cartwheeling down the aisle. Hey,
I will say he is pretty. It's a decent. It's a better cartwheel than I expected.
Really?
There's some height on it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He did get leg extension.
All right.
I mean, he's not going to win any gold medals, but
right.
better than I was expecting.
And not only that, he's wearing dress shoes and a tux and stuff, right? I would imagine.
That is correct.
Yeah. Those aren't the optimum clothing choices for cartwheeling down an aisle.
Yeah. They should be, though. I mean, I think that would make you finally watch the Olympics. Simone Biles
went down. The yeah. formal of
Yeah. These were the Super Emmys. That could be the formal Olympics.
The formal gyms. The formal gymnastics.
Yep. Simone Biles. Lovely.
Oh.
Louis Vuitton.
How many times did Jennifer Lawrence fall on her way? Didn't she trip twice at the Oscars?
Right, and then she also tripped getting out of her car.
Right. Oh, man. All right, how about this one? Someone nearly stole Betty Thomas's Emmy on stage. When Betty Thomas won Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Drama Series for Hill Street Blues in 1985, a man came up to accept the Emmy on her behalf. This was strange for two reasons. Thomas was actually in the audience, and she had no idea who the guy was. The mystery man turned out to be Barry Bremen, a.k.a. the Great Imposter. He was known to pull similar pranks at large sporting events, including the Super Bowl. The Emmys were just his latest target, and it cost him. He walked away from that stunt with a $175 fine and 6 months probation. I remember that. I do remember that. Yeah. And this guy, if this guy, Barry Bremen, I don't know some of the other, what did he do? What would he do at the Super Bowl? Would he go grab somebody's MVP trophy? I don't understand. I don't understand what he would do at the Super Bowl. But anyway, he was the Great Imposter.
Posed as a line judge referee.
So that was his deal? He would just go to places and pose as something that he wasn't, which is why he was the Great Imposter.
Just as the San Diego Chicken, but was stopped before entering Super Bowl 16, it looks like.
There's only one San Diego Chicken, man. Don't even try it. All right. Was this guy still around?
In 1986, while wearing a New York Mets uniform, Brenman shagged flies in the outfield during the All-Star pregame at the Houston Astros when he was discovered and berated by NL All-Star coach, then L.A. Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda.
Of course. Of course.
Could you imagine that? Could you imagine the verbal takedown Lasorda?
Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, man. That would be the best. Those are some of the best meltdowns, the best, like, audio meltdowns of all time involve Lasorda. And Earl Weaver, too. He's legendary for his meltdowns. That's a whole other gang right there. Yeah. But Lasorda, there's some vintage audio. I've got a CD at home that someone made. It was a compilation of all the best, like, sports meltdowns. And Lasorda took up, like, three-quarters of it. It was all Lasorda, and Earl Weaver was great, too. And, of course, Lee Elia's meltdown.
Sure.
Which is legendary from 1983.
I saw you posted on Hal McCray's anniversary.
That's my favorite sports meltdown of all time. As Hal McCray, when he was the manager of the Kansas City Royals, this was in 1993, and they had, the Royals had been had a rough go of it for a while. They were not having a good season. They lost a whole bunch in a row. So he was having a press conference in his office, Hal McCray, and he's sitting at his desk in his office. And someone asked him, you know, why he didn't switch pitchers at this certain time. And I guess, you know, Hal had it. And he just started going nuts and swearing and yelling. And then he started ripping phones off the desk and throwing stuff around the room, knocking stuff off his desk. And telling everybody to get out. All the reporters are leaving. One guy had like a gash on his face from something that McCray had thrown. As the reporters are leaving, you see one of them with blood on his face, and they're all walking out. They walk out. He comes back outside. He opens up the door, starts screaming at him again, and then says, like, put that in your pipe and smoke it, after screaming and then slamming the door. It is a legendary, legendary sports meltdown. It's my favorite sports meltdown of all time. And I was living with Mr. Scott Oaken at that time, and I can't tell you the number of times we watched Sports Center that night and just repeatedly watched it over and over and over again. I taped it, and we watched this thing. I can't even tell you how many times we watched Hal McCray lose his mind the night that it happened. And the next day I bought a Royals hat, and it just because I loved it so much, I went out and I bought a Royals hat. Never been a Kansas City Royals fan in my entire life, but I was a Hal McCray fan after that. But the key to why that's such a special meltdown, Dan, besides the fact that he injured one of the reporters and he went nuts and swore, you know, he's in his long johns. That's the part.
Yep.
That's the detail that is just, he's got his jersey on. You know, he's got the Royals jersey on. And then when he stands up from behind the desk and steps back, he's wearing long johns for this entire meltdown, whipping stuff, swearing, walking out into the hallway, long johns. That is the detail. That's the crowning detail of why the Hal McCray meltdown is so spectacular. So, all right. We got a break here. We got weather. And we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk more Emmy facts and more about Alan Alda and his cartwheel. So, but right now, let's break for some weather. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on 18th floor, 303 Wacker, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and my main man, Steve Cochran, at 6 for your morning drive on this Monday morning. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. That's coming up as well. We're talking about the Emmys. The Emmys are going to be handed out. The 70th Annual Emmy Awards will be handed out tonight. I will watch it, and we will talk about it tomorrow morning with our good friend Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter, who joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. He gave us some of his thoughts and his predictions this past Thursday, and so we're going to get his thoughts on the the broadcast and the winners and the losers and the speeches and all that cool stuff. So tune in for that. Right.
By the way, Texas are letting us know that the Emmy Awards rotate network between the four major networks.
Oh.
So this year's NBC, the other year before that it was the ABC, Fox, and CBS.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. That makes sense considering it's the Emmys.
Yep.
Okay. All right. And we were also learning about Barry Bremen, the great imposter. Ay, ay, ay. All right. Cable shows weren't eligible for Emmy Awards until 1988. Up until the late 1980s, only network shows were eligible for Emmy consideration. Could you imagine if that were the case now?
Certainly would be interesting.
I mean, because so much content is on cable and right. streaming and all. I mean, like, a dominating amount of content.
Right. It almost would be interesting to re-split them up.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, I know that's one of the things people point to. You know, there's a big difference between producing an 8-episode season, quote unquote, for Netflix
yep.
and 24 episodes for whatever, you know, an NBC show.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. So up until the late 1980s, only network shows were eligible for Emmy consideration. Cable series competed for prizes at their own award show, the Cable Ace Awards. I remember the Cable Ace Awards. But the Emmys modified their rules in 1988 to allow cable programming in. The last Cable Ace Awards ceremony took place in 1997. I used to watch the Cable Ace Awards. That's where stuff like Dream On would win awards. Do you remember Dream On, Dave?
Oh, sure.
That was one of the first like regular shows that had boobs on it. Like a cable comedy, like half an hour comedy show. Who was the Brian Benben?
You are correct.
Brian Benben was the lead in that show, and it consisted of him having like memories from old movies, right? That would pop up. Like he would I think he would like have like a flashback or something and in his head a clip from an actual old movie would pop up.
The opening indicates that Martin's mother was friendly and always parked him in front of the TV, hence the association with intercourse with memories. The show was notable for its frequent use of clips from old movies and TV shows to express Martin's inner feelings and life, which lent to much of its quirky appeal.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Dream On. Almost as good as Arliss. You know those early cable days, man.
By the way, Brian Benben?
Yeah.
Married to Madeline Stowe.
I did know that. Married to Matt. Whatever happened to her?
She's still around. She does things.
Does she?
Yeah.
I like Madeline Stowe. If I'm not mistaken, John Landis is one of the executive producers of Dream On, which explains the boobs, because whenever you see a John Landis movie, you can always expect to see boobs.
I do not see him listed.
Oh, okay.
But maybe coincidentally enough, the quote-unquote creators of Friends, Matthew Marta Kaufman and David Crane, also produced this show.
They did?
Yes.
I should have known that.
Right.
They were my partners.
Well, I was going to say, did they steal the idea from you, or were they partners?
Oh, no. I think I had the idea, and I decided to share with them because of my love for Dream On. All right. Here's one. Lorne Michaels is the most Emmy-nominated person of all time. The most Emmy-nominated individual of all time is Saturday Night Live creator Lorne Michaels with a whopping 87 nominations. Wow. He'll compete this year for outstanding writing for a variety series for SNL, and he'll also executive produce the Emmy Awards ceremony itself, which explains Che and Jost. When it comes to actual wins, HBO Documentary Films president Sheila Nevins has got Michaels beat. She collected a total of 31 Emmy Awards over the years, more than twice Michaels' 15 wins. That's not a really great record, though, right, Dan? 87 nominations and 15 wins?
It's not a good percentage.
No, it's not. Yeah, Lorne Michaels. Well, you know, Lorne Michaels, though, I mean, he basically, all of late night NBC is him.
That's true, man.
He produces The Tonight Show. He produces the Late Show, or the, what the hell is it called? The Seth Meyers Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Yeah.
Right. He produces that. So, I mean, basically all of NBC late night programming is all him. You know, not to mention all the movies that have been made from SNL. He's got his name on those. He's got his name everywhere. And Saturday Night Live is the most celebrated series. Over its 43-year history, Saturday Night Live has racked up a total of 252 nominations and 62 wins and counting. That makes it the most nominated show in Emmy history. That's amazing. And I know that A.D. Bryant, Leslie Jones, both of those people, for inexplicable reasons, are nominated tonight. And Kate McKinnon, for a very explicable reason, is nominated. And Alec Baldwin is nominated. And the guy I'm rooting for, he won't win. I'm rooting for Kenan Thompson. Kenan Thompson is the longest running cast member in the history of SNL. And stretches of time where people just badmouth Kenan Thompson. I don't understand it. I think Kenan Thompson is hilarious and always has been hilarious. Hell, I like him in Good Burger. I don't, you know. But he is like the workhorse of that show, and he's consistently funny. I would love to see him win tonight. He won't. But, you know, it's nice that he got nominated. He finally got some recognition after all these years on the show. So, all right, let's take a break here. And then we got a few more facts about Emmys, about the Emmys, and then we'll talk about Happy States right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little bit. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page. We are going to be talking about the happiest states. Which states are the happiest? But right now, I'm giving you some facts, some little tidbits and facts about the Emmys. The 70th annual Emmy Awards will be handed out tonight. I'm going to watch it, and then we're going to have our good friend Dan Feinberg on tomorrow morning on the show to talk about the aftermath and what he liked about it and what he didn't like about it in the broadcast and all that stuff. So we've been just going over some Emmy facts. You know, I'm looking up at the TV, Dan, one of the screens here that we have. Is on Cheaters right now. Now, How many Emmys is that one? That has to have won like at least 200 Emmys.
I'm surprised it didn't sweep.
Cheaters, the greatest names of hosts ever on that show: Tony Grand, Joey Greco, and now Clark Gable. All right. How about this? The Television Academy really loves cops. If you're serious about winning that statuette, it's best to pick up a badge and a gun. In 2015, Rolling Stone crunched the numbers and discovered that characters in law enforcement received the most Emmy love. It adds up when you look at past acting winners, like Dennis Franz, for he won 4 for his run on NYPD Blue. Tony Shalhoub won 3 for Monk. Is he a cop?
I always thought he was a detective.
Yeah, well, I guess that... I thought he was a private investigator, but I... okay. Tyne Daly and Sharon Gless collectively have earned 6 as the stars of Cagney and Lacey. So they like the cops. Well, Dennis Franz won 4, huh? As the one and only Sipowicz? Wow. Dan, did you watch NYPD Blue?
I did not. I was too young for those controversial shows.
Oh, because there's all kinds of butts hanging out and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Wikipedia does have Monk as a detective.
Okay. I don't know why I thought
but
he
also
was
a police procedural.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, how about this one? This next little tidbit. Some winners have to pay for their statuettes. For categories where the winners can include 15 to 20 people, like writing teams, the Television Academy imposes some fees. How about that? You got to pay for it? That's not fair. So basically, what does that mean? That everybody at The Daily Show has had to pay? Or SNL? You ever see some of these writing staff
right,
when they go up
like
on stage?
People.
It's ridiculous.
It's like an Earth, Wind, and Fire concert.
It costs $400 and takes over 5 hours to make one Emmy. Charging winners to collect their prize might seem outrageous, but then again, an Emmy isn't cheap. Each statuette costs about $400 and requires 5.5 hours of labor to create. They're all made at Chicago's R.S. Owens, where employees mold and then coat the figures in copper, nickel, silver, and gold. That's where all the awards are made, right?
I believe.
Here in
I
Chicago?
Believe so, yeah.
I know the Oscars are made here, and I'm assuming it's the same company, R.S. Owens. And then finally, the Emmys overcame a diversity hurdle in 2015 when Isabel Sanford won Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for The Jeffersons. In 1981, she was the first black woman to receive that honor. The corresponding drama category remained all white for over six decades until 2015. 2 years ago, Viola Davis won the Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama Series for How to Get Away with Murder. She used her acceptance speech to talk about race and opportunity, provoking tears from several audience members and wild applause from her fellow nominee Taraji P. Henson. This year will bring even more diversity to the category, as Sandra Oh is the first Asian actor to compete for the coveted lead actress in a drama statuette for her role in Killing Eve, which is a great show. And they've already broke a race barrier with the Emmys that were handed out already, Dan.
Yes.
Because all of the guest actors, both lead and supporting, were all African-American.
Correct.
Which is quite a thing. So, all right, well, there you go. There are some facts about the Emmys. You know, if you're having an Emmy party tonight, you can dazzle everybody in the room with your knowledge now. You know what the Emmy is named after. You know that Alan Alda did a cartwheel. Super Emmys, that didn't work. And, of course, the...
Hal McCray wears long johns.
Hal McCray wears long johns, that's right. Hey, that was on TV. They should have given him a special award.
Yeah, where's the ESPY for Best Meltdown?
Do they have an ESPY for meltdowns?
They don't, but they should.
They should.
Yeah. Right after for best gymnastics performance in a
tux.
Evening wear.
In evening wear, right. All right. So the happiest states in America. You care to guess which ones are the happiest? 312-981-7200. Wallet Hub has put together the 2018 Happiest States in America report, and it finds that the happiest states are rich in nature and community. See how your state stacks up. Well, we're going to do that. The personal finance site and app ranked 2018's happiest states in America, finding that some states are doing significantly better in the pursuit than others. We analyzed the 50 states across 31 metrics, which were chosen in conjunction with several academic experts, says Jill Gonzalez, who is a Wallet Hub analyst. The metrics were selected based on their relevance as well as availability of data. The most important metrics were the share of adult depression, suicide rates, number of work hours, job security, and the idealness of weather. So they took all of that stuff. They combined it. Happiness comes from a combination of internal and external factors. We can influence it somewhat by approaching situations positively or choosing to spend time with people we love doing activities we enjoy. One thing that doesn't drive happiness is money. Happiness only increases with wealth up to an annual income fee of $75,000. But one thing that can have a big influence is how we feel about life is where we choose to live. In this study, Wallet Hub drew upon the findings of happiness research to determine which environmental factors are linked to a person's overall well-being, satisfaction with life. Previous studies have found that good economic, emotional, physical, and social health are all key to a well-balanced, fulfilled life. To determine where Americans exhibit the best combinations of these factors, we examined the 50 states across 31 key metrics ranging from depression rate to sports participation rate to income growth. And you'll find our findings, additional insight from a panel of experts with a full description of our methodology. So that explains what the criteria has been. And they've also go into detail on some of the other reasons why people are happy in certain states and unhappy in others. So when we get into the details on that, coming up. But if you're interested in a particular state, we'll go through that, and we'll talk about being happy. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. You can also talk or text 312-981-7200, and you can also check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show for more info on that. All right, happiest states coming up, and the reasons why those states are happy coming up on the show. But we got a break here for weather. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. My dad will have a joke coming up in just a little bit. And our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And if you would like to join us, talk or text, we're talking about the happiest states in America. And they have emotional and physical well-being rank. There is a work environment rank and a community and environment rank. And the number one, and Dan, this doesn't really come as a surprise, does it?
I don't think so.
Number one happiest state is Hawaii. Total score is 68.27. In the emotional and physical well-being rank, it's first. It's number one. In the work environment rank, it's 30. That's not a great score. In the community and environment rank, it's number four. It has four. Utah comes in next with 67.8. It ranks at number 18 in the emotional and physical well-being rank, number one in work environment, and number two in community environment rank. And then Minnesota is next, scoring pretty high in the emotional and physical rank at number two. Six in the work environment, 10 community environment. Number five is North Dakota, 65.62. And number four is North Dakota. Number five is California with 63.1. But Hawaii edges out Utah. So the five happiest states based on the metrics are Hawaii, Utah, Minnesota, North Dakota, with California coming in at number five. The bottom-ranking states were Oklahoma, Alaska, Louisiana, and Arkansas, with West Virginia slumping in at number 50. There are some differences from last year's results, like Hawaii moving up from third to first place this year, or North Dakota up from 14th to 4th. However, we do not encourage comparisons between reports from different years, as we have updated our methodology since then. Perhaps the most standout of the list is what lies in Wallet Hub's intro, which notes that money doesn't drive happiness and cites that happiness only increases with wealth up to an annual income of $75,000 based on 2010 research. It's cheerful but difficult sentiment to buy, particularly when you consider that Hawaii was the highest cost of living in the U.S. You're probably not relocating to Hawaii unless you're doing very well financially. If you're living there without the means, you could be among nearly 11% of the population struggling with poverty. But Hawaii has something that is invaluable, a relatively relaxed attitude and this great social interaction and outdoorsy adventures. Hawaii's happiness ranking is really attributed to culture, Pamela Gail Johnson said, founder of the Secret Society of Happy People. Wait, what? There's a Secret Society of Happy People?
There is.
Wow, all right. There's a city environment, but culturally it's more laid back, which contributes to emotional and physical well-being. There's lots of beaches. There's walking and hiking. It's an environment that fosters stop and smell the roses mentality. Still, it's interesting that of all 50 states, Hawaii was the lowest, had the lowest adequate sleep rate. Perhaps there's an argument for pulling an all-nighter in the name of happiness. You know why, Dan, that Hawaii is ranked so high, why it's number one.
Why is that?
Spam.
Oh, sure.
If you can get spam everywhere at restaurants all over the place and at McDonald's and fast food places, you'd be happy. That would make you very happy. So I think it's spam. I think all of this metric stuff that they're doing here and the analysis, it's very simple. Spam.
I thought you were going to go Magnum PI.
Well, that's a, you know, Magnum PI is a good one, but not this new Magnum PI. No mustache, no Magnum. All right, so you want to know where Illinois is ranked? It's pretty much smack dab in the middle. It comes in at number 23. With a total score of 52.47, it comes in at number 12 on the emotional and physical well-being rankings. Number 45 on the work environment rank. Wow, that's low. People are not happy with their work here in Illinois? And number 44 with community and environment rank. So people don't like each other and they don't like their jobs, but emotionally and physically they're okay. Is that what we're getting here?
That is interesting. The 312 texted in, happiness in Illinois would be lower property taxes.
Well, that's true.
870 says, I have a pretty good life here in Arkansas. I was also born in Oklahoma. Forgive me, Esmeralda, but this list is trash.
Yeah, Arkansas comes in number 49 on the list. So, yeah, so Illinois is like right in the middle. How much does weather have to do with that? You know, do they keep that? They do, right? Because it's, I mean, obviously Hawaii has fantastic weather, so that makes you a little bit happier.
You would have to imagine, yeah.
Because a lot of people are completely miserable in the winter here.
You said Minnesota was pretty high on this list?
Yeah.
312, spam is big in Minnesota, too.
Oh, see? I'm telling you, it's all spam.
Where's Pennsylvania? Because what is that? How is Scrapple related to spam? Is that similar? Or?
No, spam's better than Scrapple, although I like Scrapple. Pennsylvania comes in at number 30. Come in at number 30 with a score of 50.54. So yeah, but no, Scrapple's good though. Yeah, so I think the Illinois thing makes sense to me to be right smack dab in the middle. I think that makes sense. I don't think that's disappointing or surprising in the least. Utah touts low divorce rates, work-life balance, and a community efforts. So there's not a lot of divorce. And, well, because if you get a divorce, you're going to get 12 of them if you're in Utah, right? Don't you know? You get multiple divorces. And then West Virginia and Arkansas, their economy are red flags. They have a lot of economy woes, though. Wallet Hub champions the idea that you can't buy happiness. Bottom-ranking states, West Virginia and Arkansas, underscore the importance of a vital economy and the unhappiness the lack of it can bring. West Virginia was the worst state for business, according to a 2017 poll, while Arkansas came in at number 41. Both states improved just slightly in the same poll in 2018, coming out at 48 and 40, respectively. These states were also bottom dwellers on Wallet Hub's 2018 best and worst state economies list. I think both West Virginia and Arkansas, you have to look at the economy, says Johnson. They rank low on the work front and on the emotional and physical well-being front, and I think it's a piece of that is interconnected to the jobs. I doubt the average wage there amounts to $75,000 a year. I could contribute to the high rate of adult depression. Arkansas came in at number 48 and West Virginia at 49. So those are the most depressed states. Following up here, Idaho came in at number 6. Maryland came in at number 7. You know why? Crab cakes. Iowa at 8. South Dakota at 9. Nebraska, 10. Wisconsin, 11. Connecticut, 12. 13, New Jersey. 14, New York. 15, Virginia. So basically, are we the lowest ranked Midwest state?
Indiana's 32.
Oh, Indiana's 32. Okay. All right. New York coming in at number 14. Why am I surprised about that? Why would I think that New York would be lower? I don't know why.
That's also got a big swing where the well-being rank is 5, but the work environment and the community environment are 42 and 39, respectively.
Right. Well, the work environment, I mean, you think it's expensive to live in Hawaii, which it is. I mean, New York's a big state, but whenever I think New York, I think Manhattan, I think the boroughs and how expensive it is. You know, you really have to have a great job and a good amount of money, you know, to live, especially if you're going to try and live in New York City. But yeah, coming in at number 14, New York. New Jersey is above New York. Wow. In the ranking. And it comes in at number 3 on the emotional. Wow. And the emotional and physical well-being rank. New Jersey's number 3? I mean, it's pretty low, the other ones, though. 44 in the work environment, 38 in the community environment. So, all right. Let's take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we'll talk more happiness. Have you guys lived in different states, and where were you the most happy? And are you happy here in Illinois? Or if you're not in Illinois, what do you think of this ranking? 312-981-7200 right here on WGN. The news is going to be coming up right after this. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here, and we are here till 5 o'clock. It is Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, which he does every Monday morning. So, yeah. And that'll be coming up here in just a few minutes. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. And yeah. We're talking about being happy in different states. So Wallet Hub did this study where they ranked the happiest states in America. And Hawaii came out on top. And on the bottom is West Virginia, Arkansas, and Louisiana are near the bottom. So I guess Louisiana, I immediately start thinking of New Orleans. But there's more to Louisiana than just New Orleans, because I can't imagine not being happy living in New Orleans. Although it gets real hot down there, like ridiculously hot. So, but yeah. Now, the important thing is that they say that you can be happy anywhere, even in West Virginia. it's important to understand happiness is a state of being, and that can be experienced rather than a status quo or end goal to be achieved. Frank Niles, PhD, a social scientist, adventure athlete, and executive educator, finds happiness does have a formula and zip codes aren't part of it. Adventure athlete. He's an adventure athlete.
Finally, someone's claimed the title.
Yeah. Does he wear a tux? Happiness comes down to being physically and emotionally healthy, pursuing things that are meaningful to us personally, and contributing to something larger than ourselves, Niles adds, saying that time with other people is critical to this pursuit. If you think about it, the most meaningful experiences we've had in our lives have been with other people. So if you were to ask me, what can I do to be more happy? I would say live fully in the present, seek ways to make a difference in the lives of other people every day, and make time in your life to build healthy relationships that are defined by giving and receiving support. That sounds like healthy advice. Yeah. So let's see. Virginia comes in at 15, 16 is Massachusetts, 17 is Washington, 18 Colorado, although their work environment comes in real high. North Carolina net 20, Arizona 21, 22 is Texas, 23 is us, Illinois, 24 New Hampshire, 25 Kansas, 26 Nevada. That's because everybody, it's pretty low because everybody's blowing their money. Because they're all gambling. How can you have a healthy mental attitude there? It says emotional and physical well-being ranking for Nevada is number 40. Comes in 40. 27, Delaware. 28, Montana. 29, Florida. That seems high to me. I don't know why. Not really sure why, but 29 seems kind of high for Florida. Number 30 is Pennsylvania, 31 Rhode Island, 32 Indiana, 33 Maine, 34 Michigan. Wow, Michigan ranked lower than Indiana. 35 Wyoming, 36 South Carolina. Ohio comes in at 37, Vermont 38, Oregon 39. Tennessee 40, New Mexico 41, Missouri 42, Mississippi 43, Kentucky 44, Alabama 45, Oklahoma 46, Alaska 47, and then Louisiana, Arkansas, West Virginia round out the bottom. Interesting. Now, I'm not even familiar with Wallet Hub, Dan.
They do stuff like this a lot, this type of studies about happiness or best drivers in each state and things like that.
Mm. Wallet Hub. Okay. So that's your states in your top five: Hawaii, Utah, Minnesota, North Dakota, and California. And for us, we're Illinois. We're ranked smack right in the middle, about in the middle, 23. So, which doesn't surprise me. Now, see, what are little things that make you happy, Dan? I have some stuff here from Mashable.com where employees of Mashable pick little things in life that make them happy. What makes you, Dan? It's obviously your daughters and
sure.
Your family, you know?
Yeah, those would be the big ones. Small things. Because I'm an old man just looking for wedges now.
Yeah.
Smooth sidewalks. because when I take those girls for walks and I have to push a stroller, man,
right.
You get the uneven sidewalks.
Yeah, sure.
You're constantly, you know, if you're not paying attention, you're crashing into it. And I may or may not let Emily not always wear the shoulder restraints so she might fall out every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. That's simple. That's good. I'm trying to think what makes me happy. Nothing. Well, this show makes me happy. I love doing this show, and I love my listeners. That's a good thing. It is, you know, I have to say this. You know, I've had jobs that I've hated in the past that I wasn't crazy about or I didn't like. There's a huge difference when you like your job. You know what I mean?
For sure.
Because, I mean, you know, spending 40 hours a week at a place you can't stand or doing a job that you don't like is really, it'll suck the soul out of you. I know a lot of people, you know, have that, but that's not the issue with us. I mean, we like our jobs. I'm speaking.
That's what I always tell people. It beats working for a living.
Yeah, it's a fantastic job, and I think that adds to whatever your psyche is. You know, so here are some little things that make people. What is it that makes you happy? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. These are the Mashable employees are talking about little things in life that make them happy, and they've mentioned some of these. Clothes fresh out of the dryer. Yeah, that's not bad.
And there is like an entire fragrance line dedicated to that. You know?
That's true. Singing. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I don't mind it. But I have a terrible voice, so. Breaking perforated seals on just about anything. So, like, just perforated seals, you break them, and then that makes you happy.
Yeah, like opening a Cool Cut package for the first time.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'll buy that for a dollar. Peeling a clementine in one peel. Well, see, that's pretty cool. I have to say I like that. I like that. Whoever decided that was something that made them happy, I like that. Peeling a clementine in one peel. That's pretty cool. A perfectly popped bag of popcorn. Yeah, you don't want the burnt kernels on the bottom. But you never know, man. Those microwave, you know, the microwave popcorn now, there's always kernels that aren't popped in the bottom. You know, a good hair day makes you happy. I have those every day because I wear a hat. Getting off work while it's still light outside. Well, that sometimes happens for us. It's not now. It's going to be dark, you know, darker and darker. Jeggings. What is that? Are they leggings with what?
Jean leggings.
Oh, come on. Seriously?
I just would go with, you know, sweatpants or track pants. I mean, that's... Yeah. I mean, my friends and I, we have a comfy pants rule. Like, if we're having people over, we establish up front, like, comfy pants. That's it.
Yeah.
Nothing. No jeans.
That's fine with me. Because as soon as I, you know, when I get home, I go right into the PJ pants, you know, with the elastic. The ones that I currently have... That are on the edge of my bed right now that I'm going to put on when I get home have Bart Simpsons all over them. So I have Bart Simpson pants that I'm going to be wearing. So, yeah. All right. Well, what makes you happy? 312-981-7200. And again, you know, you can be happy living anywhere. So let's find out what you guys think. 312-981-7200. Hey, you know what makes me happy? My dad telling a joke. And that's good. I think that makes a lot of people happy. My dad's going to be doing that in just a few minutes. Let us break here for the weather, and then we'll take a break for my dad's joke and more things that make you happy. Little things. 312-981-7200.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go. With your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
All right. That's right. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studios here live on a Monday morning. And Monday morning means that my dad calls in and tells a joke. Coming up after 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And then after 6, Steve Cochran with your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke. Let's say hello to my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Real good.
Good. How's Ma?
Good.
All right. You got a joke?
Got a joke. A man heard about the discovery of gold in California. He immediately packed up his belongings and moved out west. 6 months later, he gave up and returned home. It didn't pan out.
All right. All right.
Oh, yeah. It didn't pan out, poor guy. All right, Dad.
I tell a joke. I bring out of the vault and tell a jewel, you know. And this week I got word I bought a dog from a blacksmith, brought him home, he made a bolt for the door. That's the one I brought out of the vault.
Yeah, you told us that one, Dad.
I know.
Oh, okay.
I bring them out.
Yeah, so the classic ones.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, Dad.
All right, have a good day.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Okay.
There you go. There's my dad. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We were talking about the happiest states in order. Hawaii came in number one. And then what other little things make you happy? Because according to some of these studies, you can be happy anywhere. Now, we were talking, one of the people at Mashable, the employees at Mashable, picked jeggings. Now, Mary, you wanted to comment on jeggings?
Oh, well, jeggings are extremely tight, skinny pants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women wear them, and they are so hard to get off. I mean, you can get them on, and it's so, they're like awful. They look great once you get them on, but it's like, okay, how am I going to get these off? I mean, it's like a twister routine every time you have to try to get. And I have rather thin legs.
Yeah.
And I have a problem. People with heavier legs, I can't even imagine.
Wow.
But yeah, so jeggings look, they look great, but wow.
And they do look, they do look like tight jeans, right? That's what
They're tight, like almost painted on jeans, you know, once you get them on. But,
right, but you can't get them off.
They're in other materials, too. They're not just jean materials.
Okay.
Yeah.
But. All right. Well, there they are. But have fun trying to remove them.
Oh, man.
Okay.
Especially when you've had a few glasses of wine.
There you go. Yeah, a few glasses of wine.
Well, whatever. I mean, you know, okay.
All right. I think maybe after a few glasses of wine, any kind of pants are hard to take off, I would imagine.
You might as well just sleep in them.
Yeah, exactly right. That's Mary, by the way, who's in traffic this morning. We got some texts coming in about what little things make people happy. 312 area code says, my children's success makes me happy. 608 area code says, symmetry makes me happy. 815 area code says, an ice cold Breckenridge, a good smoke, and something on the grill, preferably a slow cooking brisket. 630 area code, when my grandkids are laughing. 608 area code says, a new pair of tennis shoes, that smell, all shiny and new. 312 area code says, zero unread emails. 815 area code says, working a squeegee when you wash bay floors at a firehouse, doing the squeegee is like therapy. Bay floors. Okay. All right, let's see what else here. Just waking up a minute before your alarm goes off so you're not jolted out of bed. Yeah, that one is, it's weird because I always set an alarm on my phone, you know, and for like the evening when I'm taking a nap, if I'm taking a nap, I always have it set for a certain time. And I have the clock radio on my nightstand also set for a minute later or whatever. But I very rarely use it. I usually get, you know, I usually kind of wake up and I look and I'm like, I'm 5 minutes earlier than usual. And then I just get up. Now, what are you alarm-wise, Dan?
I've got one on my phone for 3 o'clock every afternoon, and sometimes it works, and sometimes I sleep right through it. So. Yeah. I would have gone with waking up and realizing you still have, like, 2 hours of sleep.
Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah, no, that's a good one. How about receiving mail that isn't a bill? That very rarely happens. Very, very rarely does that happen. How about birds chirping for the first time since winter? Interpretive dancing when nobody is watching. These are things that make people happy. Clicking unsubscribe. There's the one you were just talking about, Dan. Waking up early, realizing you have hours to sleep. When the Starbucks barista spells your name right. finding money in your pocket that you forgot about. The elevator arriving the second you push the button. Paying for a small drink but getting a large. Wait a minute, that's just cheating, right?
Not if they give it to you.
Oh, if they just give it to you, okay. All right, how about some text here from our listeners. 708 area code says, chocolate cake and vanilla ice cream makes me happy. 872 says, the hum of the air conditioning helps me sleep. Now, I'm with you on that. That's why I have a fan at the foot of my bed, and when it's really warm out, I do have the air conditioner on. And yeah, that's a good thing. 224 says, being a mom to my two guinea pigs makes me very, very happy. 262 area code says, the first bite of a great Chicago-style hot dog. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. 847 area code says, the first tulips in the spring and when the steamy summer turns to fall. I like that last one a lot. 815 area code, oh, here we go. A good bowel movement makes me happy.
That's not untrue.
It's not. It's not. 815 area code says, happy wife, happy life. Music makes me happy. 870 says, your dad, that didn't pan out line, just made me spit out my coffee. Oh, wow, a spit take. Wow. That's a successful joke when you get a spit take. Sandy in Woodstock says, having a hummingbird check me out and then going to the feeder. All right. Let's see. Oh, here's a good one from the Mashable. The last one. This is a good one from the Mashable. Whenever Peanuts characters dance, I have to agree with that. That just makes me very happy. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back after this and let you know what's happening on the show tomorrow.